Abandoning your home while fleeing a wildfire can certainly be a traumatic experience. It's even scarier if you don't know where to go or if you'll feel welcome once you get there. Jefferson Public Radio spent months researching how wildfires impact people with diverse needs and backgrounds. The series is called Oppressed by Wildfire. It's in four parts, and part one features JPR's April Ehrlich speaking with Latino communities in Shasta County.
On a hot July evening in 2018, Cecilia Cabrera didn't know that the car fire was headed straight for her home in Redding.
It's still far away, but I was afraid. I told my husband, this is not looking good. Maybe we should do something. Maybe we need to prepare or something.
Cecilia was born in Peru, but she and her husband have lived in Shasta County for nearly 20 years. They've experienced wildfires before, but nothing like this. They didn't know what to do or how to prepare.
And immediately I got a phone call, get out of the house, now. Like, what? And then my cell phone, get out of the house now. And then they start knocking on the doors. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know what to take with us. It was like, get out of the house now.
Cecilia and her husband drove to her brother's house, and she soon started to worry about other people.
All the messages that I got, they were in English. But I know a lot of families that they don't speak the language and they didn't know what to do.
Shasta County has a small but growing Latino population, 10% of 180,000 people. There aren't many Spanish language resources here. No Latino community center or outreach group or local news stations. But they do have Sylvia Izaguirre. She's a community organizer with the Shasta County Health and Human Services Agency and the main bridge between local government and Latino families. After the car fire hit, the Mexican consulate contacted Sylvia.
They're very surprised. They're like, there wasn't not one Hispanic person in these evacuation centers. You know, like, what's going on? Where are they going?
So Sylvia checked the centers herself.
I didn't see signage that said entrada aquí or, you know, anything in other languages that would make people feel at ease to go in.
Sylvia says Latino families are wary of seeking disaster aid because of recent heated political debates about immigration and federal raids. She says many Latinos in Shasta County are in the process of obtaining U.S. citizenship, and they fear that accepting any public benefits could result in their being labeled a public charge and therefore denied citizenship. So instead of seeking help from shelters or programs, Latinos stick with the people they trust, their friends and family.
The families will go to people that they know, whether it's their immediate relatives or their comadre, compadre, that are out of the affected areas and stay with them. I knew of a family in Happy Valley that had 15 people.
Even California counties with large Latino populations have struggled to adapt their disaster systems for multiple languages. Oscar Chavez is the assistant director for the Sonoma County Department of Human Services, where Latinos make up a quarter of the population. He says when a deadly wildfire hit Santa Rosa in 2017, it pushed some people to near homelessness.
In some of the shelters, initially there were not staff who could speak Spanish, and so people didn't know how to access services at the shelters, and many of them ended up going to the coast to set up their own sort of makeshift camp.
Oscar says emergency services should form partnerships with Latino nonprofits or Spanish language news stations. But what about places like Shasta County, which lack those resources? Ernesto Carrillo owns Carrillo's Mexican store in Redding. It's the only place in Shasta County that sells corn husks for tamales, stone mocojetes for grinding herbs, and Mexican sweets. But it also acts as a central hub of information for people who speak Spanish. They come here to post job openings or to wire money to their families in other countries, or to just chat with Ernesto. When the car fire hit, staff with the county would send information to Ernesto, who would then post it to the shop's Facebook page in English and Spanish.
Because we have a lot of information, but it's in English. So then we have to make sure that they can read it. Even if we have people that speak almost no English or a little bit of English, but they will not be able to read it.
Most of the time, Ernesto is posting information about an upcoming concert or a visit from the Mexican consulate. But when disaster strikes, he becomes more than just a shop owner. He becomes one of the few people in Shasta County helping Latino families get the information they need to stay safe or to help with recovery afterward. April Ehrlich, JPR News.
This series was produced as a project for the USC Center for Health Journalism's 2019 California Fellowship.
And the series is called Oppressed by Wildfire. We'll be running the other three parts on the next 3 days of this week here on the Jefferson Exchange. April Ehrlich joins us now in the studio to talk about the layout of the rest of the series and the issues with reporting it. April, always good to see you.
Yep, it's great to be here.
So clearly not just where you are, but who you are can help determine what kind of outcome you'll have when a wildfire approaches. Talk about how you got into this subject matter.
Well, last year, the University of Washington and the Nature Conservancy came out with a study that looked at census tracts and how those folks fared when it came to wildfires. And they found that the study concluded that people of color, particularly Native Americans, actually were most vulnerable to wildfire. They didn't have the resources to recover after a disaster, and they also just weren't treated the same way when a wildfire struck. So that's when I decided to see how that applied to our region, to see how wildfires were impacting different people in different ways. And I decided to focus on Redding because it was hit by the Carr Fire last year, and I was in the area when that happened and reporting on it when it happened. So I figured this would be a good time, and it's been a year, so this would be a good time to delve into what the after effects were and how it's impacting our region in a deeper way.
So the series has been up for a few days on our website, and it aired on the other JPR services, the music services, a week ago. On this particular piece, noticing any follow-up thus far?
Not yet, no. I've sent it to the Redding Police Department, but my understanding is that the Shasta County Sheriff's Office is responsible, or the emergency services is responsible for emergency alerts. I haven't heard from them, but speaking to folks who were impacted by wildfires a couple years ago in like the Santa Rosa areas, they have had a lot of lessons learned, and they are trying to better their own services to accommodate people with different language needs and physical needs. So we'll see what happens. It just aired, you know, last week, and we'll see with time if there is any change to
come. It's the kind of thing that I think doesn't cross the mind of a lot of people who speak English all the time, is that you might need the alerts in different languages. And so not any effect you're noticing so far in Shasta County, but are you saying that in Santa Rosa they're thinking, or at least beginning to implement the idea of getting some alerts in Spanish?
Yeah, and it's interesting. In the print version of this story, I mention Ventura County, and by print I mean web version. Mm-hmm. But in Ventura County, which is just north of Los Angeles, there was the Thomas Fire, and there weren't any emergency alerts in English for the first 10 days. And also, when I spoke to the people of Sonoma County, the people who work there, they told me that was a big lesson that they learned, was they needed emergency alerts in multiple languages. And they even said that was, quote, stupid, that they didn't have that. And, you know, there have been some comments on our Facebook about people saying, well, that's why you should learn English when you get into this country. And
I anticipated some of that, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's more complicated. You don't get into a country and immediately know how to speak the language. I did speak to the shop owner in Redding, Ernesto Carrillo, the mm-hmm. one that was interviewed in the story. And he was like, you know, there's a lot of people who don't speak English, and when they want to speak English or learn how to speak it, they just don't have the time. They're working two jobs, or they're just working full time, and they can't take classes, can't afford classes, can't make it to the hours. They have children. It's just not that easy. And to me, to say that their inability to learn a language quickly means that they should be more susceptible to wildfire and not getting alerts in a language that they understand, that's just not fair. So, we obviously want our region to be safe when a disaster strikes, and I think that should mean accommodating everybody and their needs. But of course, that's going to be really complicated. But it seems like emergency responders are starting to take that into consideration. We've never really had major natural disasters like this, you know, in this region and the West Coast, wildfires have, you know, are just now really encroaching on large cities, and we are starting to take it more seriously. And I think that as a society, things will start to develop and change with time.
April Ehrlich, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from JPR News, her series Oppressed by Wildfire. We just heard part one, parts two, three, four. We'll air the rest of the week here on the Jefferson Exchange in the middle of the first hour. So you mentioned you were in Redding shortly after the car fire came through town. And I wonder what impressions, other than what you reported in this piece, you just sort of general feelings you had about being in the town a year after the fire.
Yeah, I actually went to an event on the day that it was like the year, I guess, anniversary since the car fire entered Redding. And they had a big event down at the bridge over there. And it seems like it's one of those large events that somewhat define a community for a while. A lot of people are pretty proud of how far they've come since the fire hit. And it seems like it's really bringing people together in that sense. And of course, you drive around town and you see a lot of, Redding Strong things and things that say, you know, we're stronger than the car fire, stuff like that. And it's interesting to see how a disaster like that could really define an area that you live in for so long.
A sense of community pride arising from surviving from the fire.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I think that it strengthened Redding in a way.
So language issues aside, I mean, the fact is that a lot of lessons were learned last year the hard way by the car fire. I mean, we remember sitting in the newsroom watching the tweets and realizing this thing is moving far faster than evacuation crews have a chance to get people out. So, I mean, is the whole process of evacuating people being thought of somewhat differently now?
I'm not sure. I mean, just from the people that I spoke to in Sonoma County, they were hit by the Santa Rosa fire, which killed 24 people, and it was one of the major wildfires we had before Paradise got hit with wildfire. And they are saying that, you know, we need to improve the way that we are letting people know that a wildfire is coming. It's not just emergency alerts in multiple languages. It's accommodating people who can't hear sirens, can't hear alerts, you know, elderly people who may not have a cell phone, who don't answer their landline phone, who don't know that people are knocking on their doors. I don't know that it seems like something that we would have thought of by now. We're not the only region that's been hit with natural disaster. Natural disaster has existed for a long time.
Right. It doesn't have to be a fire for people to need to evacuate, which is something you point up tomorrow. We'll learn about people with disabilities, physical and mental, trying to evacuate. And so evacuation is a hard enough thing. It's harder still to imagine a further set of conditions that could slow you down. But as you point out, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, this has been happening for a long time. I'm starting to think that it's just a lack of resources that keeps people from really accommodating everybody when a disaster strikes. But, you know, also, like I said earlier, wildfires just recently started becoming a major thing, and it's a learning curve for the West Coast on how to deal with wildfires and how quickly they can approach now.
April Ehrlich, again from JPR News, our guest on the Exchange. We're talking about her series, Oppressed by Wildfire, airing in four parts in the Jefferson Exchange in the middle of the first hour through this week. And this is sort of an overview of the series. Part one aired just a few moments ago, if you missed it. It'll be online. It is online already under the Oppressed by Wildfire banner. Just look on the upper right side of the website to find the link there. So it seems like we make some assumptions about evacuations, that everybody can move to their car quickly. Everybody can get to their car quickly. Their car is okay. They can get out. None of which are necessarily true, because obviously there's some deficiencies in people's own physical well-being and ability to get to a car, whether or not they have a working car. And it turns out whether they have a home is an issue in this series as well.
Yeah. So FEMA, the Federal Disaster Organization, they decipher the law, the Stafford Act, that determines how we should spend our federal natural disaster resources. They interpret it in a way that you're only supposed to bring up people to where they were before a disaster strikes. So the way that they see it, if you were homeless before a disaster, they're not going to provide shelter to you or any disaster aid to you. Which I guess a lot of folks would say, well, why would we provide shelter to somebody if they didn't have a shelter before? We're just, you know, we wouldn't have enough room for everybody. But the problem with that is when a wildfire strikes, there's a lot of, there's the physical danger of actually being close to the fire, but then there's also the danger of inhaling smoke all day, all night, and dealing with the heat all day and all night. Things are just different. The world becomes a hellscape when a wildfire hits a large city like Redding, and it's not safe for anybody to be outside for long periods of time. It is difficult for people who are homeless to deal with wildfires. In Redding, they have an overnight shelter. There's only one. It's called the Good News Rescue Mission, but it's a faith-based organization, and it's what some people would call a high barriers shelter. It's difficult to get in and stay in because they have a lot of rules and regulations you have to follow.
We'll hear about that on Thursday in this piece, and then Friday we turn to the issue of fire as part of an ecosystem process applied by humans with centuries essentially of knowledge.
Yeah, I wanted to wrap up the piece with an example of a group that uses wildfire management and incorporates cultural knowledge and history into it successfully, and that was a lot of Native American tribes. They are starting to do more cultural burns like they used to before Western colonization. Centuries of living on their land taught them that they could manage and keep their forests healthy by setting what we would call prescribed burns, setting fires in the forest during certain times of the year. And that benefited them in a lot of ways. It kept the forests clear of debris, but it also produced ash that killed pests that infected trees and their crops. And it also helped create a diverse landscape that they would use. Like there's like plants that, you know, are produced that they make baskets out of, and those plants only exist in a forest that interacts with fire. So anyway, I spoke with a few folks who are using cultural burns to keep their forests healthy, and kind of concluded the piece with that. Here's an example of an agency that does incorporate cultural knowledge into its fire management and disaster management plans.
That'll be on Friday's piece. Just a couple seconds left here. I mean, we talked to you a couple months ago when you were getting started with the field reporting. You've worked for newspapers. You've worked on major projects. How does this compare to any of those?
It was really difficult. It's really difficult to get people to tell their personal stories, especially when it comes to something that involves race and economy. So it was a hard one to take on, but I'm glad we got it done, and I'm glad that we got these stories told.
The series is called Oppressed by Wildfire. All the parts are up on the website, ijpr.org, right now. We have a link to part one coming up by this afternoon on jeffexchange.org, which, of course, is part of ijpr.org. So we'll continue with the series as well through the rest of the week. April Ehrlich put several months into this. April, thanks so much for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.